Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we aim to be as good at the human side of healthcare as we are at the clinical side of healthcare. My name is Chris Desmond. I'm a physiotherapist who's fascinated by how we can better help the person with the problem. Join us as we learn how to connect better, how to show up better, and how to understand our patients and ourselves better. Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Chris Desmond. This is a show where we explore the human side of healthcare and how we can get better at doing that. Today, I'm joined by Jack Holroyd, who identifies as a gay man, a queer historian, an activist, and who works as a physiotherapist in South London. Jack, welcome to the show, mate. I'm excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Jack, I'd like to kick off with the first question is, why do you care about the human side of healthcare? Why do you care about the people side?
You know, I used to be, like, when I went to university, I was surrounded by these, like, the faculty at my university was really, really interested in lots and lots of qualitative research. And I was really dismissive of it. These people were kind of role models to me in physiotherapy, and we'll talk about them later. But I was really, really dismissive of it. I came from sporting backgrounds. I worked in the cycle trade for many years, including with some elite riders. And yeah, I had this very kind of biomechanical hardline approach, went straight into MSK when I graduated. I knew kind of like knew where I was going. And very, very quickly, I realized, like, actually, like, as a profession, we don't know squat. And started to kind of look into some more kind of the qualitative research and realizing, like, actually what matters in the clinic, what I can see. I used to do manual therapy as a way of, like, okay, I want a result at the end of this appointment for this patient to feel better. And then I'd move on to doing exercise. How do I make this feel better? This patient feel better by the end of this appointment. And what ended up happening, as such things do, is the patients that were going to get better by themselves, the well-off, the well-educated, the people with good healthcare outcomes who didn't smoke, who had a good upbringing, they got better. And they left the clinic, and my caseload went up and up and up with patients with long-term and chronic pain, and they weren't getting better. And I realized that actually the ones that started to become more independent and self-manage are the ones where I took a moment and I listened to them. And I did some research of, kind of went to one of Peter O'Sullivan's courses. And kind of like, it's something that I've become very passionate about. It's very close to my heart, is helping people. I came into healthcare primarily. I mean, I initially came into healthcare because I thought it was an advancement in the cycle trade and it would pay me more. But I ended up, like, very quickly kind of turned things around. Like, at the bottom line, we come into healthcare to help people, and we need to help the people who need the help the most. So if you're going to do that, you need to understand socioeconomic factors behind why your patients are sick. If you're going to do that, you need to understand why patients don't get better. And kind of to some degree, we need to understand that we think we've got the answers in terms of the treatment programs we have, but these work for some patients and not for other patients. And we need to ask why that is.
Mm. And was that a pretty quick realization for you to come to? When you started to work as a physiotherapist, especially kind of coming from that very biomedical, very sporting, very measurement-based background?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it was about 6 months in, and wow. I realized I am a torturer. I am going to patients come in and they've had pain for 20 years, and my approach was, okay, let's say, like, You've had lots of manual therapy, for example. Let's take a different route. Let's do rehab, and it's going to be tough. And I explained to them at the start, this is how I work, and you're welcome to join me on this. You're welcome. I can cross-review somebody else. And so many of the patients were so keen on getting a fix that they went, yes, let's do rehab together. And I would push these patients till they couldn't get out of bed the next day. And I'd take patients with fibromyalgia and push them really hard because they just need conditioning. And yeah, like, it wasn't more than 6 months in, and I realized, like, Jack, you are a brute. you are hurting these patients and you're doing more harm than you're doing good. And that was quite a painful realization to go, oh, actually, I need to unlearn everything that I've learned, everything that I, to some degree, that I learned from my educators, my clinical educators, and start paying attention to the stuff that my role models in university were telling me to pay attention to when I thought I knew best.
And it's quite an uncomfortable experience to go through, I think, as
damn
well.
Right.
Did you feel supported in changing the way that you practiced and the way that you approached it?
Not particularly. I think there's a tribalism in physio, and there's certainly a tribalism in how we see kind of the manual therapy versus the rehab approach. But there's a tribalism that makes it difficult to change tack. I was working for an organization that is fairly well known in the UK, a non-NHS independent health provider. And they really, really helped me to certainly develop my clinical reasoning. And the press was always on to reason better, to think wider. But actually the entire organization was rehab, rehab, rehab. And at some point I had to say, well, actually, I'm becoming a company man. After a few years working there, I was kind of like, this is my entire experience as a physio, is working in this organization. And to be able to kind of go, I need to work somewhere else. I need to move on. I need to also start asserting myself and going, right, actually, like, I've worked... as an aside from working in the cycle trade for years, I worked in a voluntary role for a number of equity and diversity charities, including like trustee positions, and starting to go, actually, let's pull in some of this information and some of this background skill set, and realizing like, actually, I'm burning out trying to be this person that I'm not, trying to perform for the company, trying to, yeah, like really kind of push my clinical reasoning and my practice along, but being constrained by the structure. And I mean, now the structure of the NHS just as much as the structure of an independent organization. Mm. But when you've been a physio for 3-4 years, it's difficult to assert oneself, to go like, actually, you know what? Now, I'm very grateful for everyone for their advice and their input, but now I need to say something.
Yeah. And contextually for everyone, how long have you been a physiotherapist for now?
So I graduated in early 2018.
Okay.
So I'm new to the game. I'm a band six in the NHS. So yeah. I always call us the meat grinders, in that our job is to see more patients than everyone else and to really, really hammer ourselves on the clinical reasoning side. I was on an accelerated program in MSK straight out of university. So I became band six, I think it was 8 months after I started. And then, yeah, I've been doing that since.
Yeah. And I think thank you for sharing that. I think your story as well, in regards to kind of some of the challenges around working within a larger system, is it's not unique to people just starting out their career as well. I've been a physiotherapist now mm-hmm. for 15 years and have felt similar challenges at different parts through my physio journey. Regular listeners of the show will know that I have been off on parental leave for the last almost a year now, which has been absolutely fantastic. But even kind of towards the end of my clinical practice, before I went away and to be a dad, that was something that I felt really challenged by, as well as feeling kind of constrained by a system in terms of how I could show up at work and bring all of myself and all of the things that I was interested in. And I mean, Jack, like, you're a dude who is quite out there. Like, you have a large personality, and I'm just wondering, like, as you kind of stepped into a physiotherapy role, did you feel that you needed to repress some of that personality to kind of fit in, for want of a better word?
Yes and no. So when I first came, my first year in university came to a bit of a head at one point, and the university had to take me to one side and go, Jack, we love who you are, but you need to turn this down a little bit. And yeah, I'm a lot like ADHD, being deaf means I'm loud, having been kind of like openly, assertively queer since I was in my early teens, I've kind of got to a stage where I don't give a shit what other people think of me. And so therefore, yeah, that was a lot. And then it wasn't necessarily a conscious decision. I realized at that point, okay, at university, I need to be professional as well. When you go out on placement, essentially the min-max way of getting a good placement grade is to emulate your clinical educator. Because if you do practice the way that they do practice, then they like you. And if you don't do practice the way that they do, and I've noticed this as a clinical educator myself, to realize that actually there are people who really don't do practice the way that I do and are going to be very different physios from I am. The way I am, and I have to work really hard to help them to be that physio, not be me, because Christ knows, like, physio doesn't need another one of me. But yeah, like the weight of all kind of like six week placements and stress and writing essays and kind of everything like that, by the time when you come out of university, all of us have been, we have our personalities and we have our opinions, but broadly speaking, like, you're stepping out into the world where you recognize that you know nothing. You recognize you're at the bottom of that Dunning-Kruger slump, as it were, and you realize you've got a roller coaster right in front of you, and you're looking straight up vertically at your learning curve that's going to be happening over the next couple of years. And I feel like it kind of breaks you down a little bit. And one of the professors at my university, a chap called Dr. John Hammond, writes about, in his PhD thesis, he was talking about how students are constructed within the model of professionalism. And our default model of professionalism is white, middle. For some reason in physiotherapy, our default model is male, despite the fact 74% of physios in the UK are female. But 70% of published research in physiotherapy is male and male-led. And the amount of that, there should be no team that is entirely male in physio. But some of the leading documents that we all run off in terms of the research that we flock to is run by all male teams. And we go, how did you contrive a situation where the best person for the job were all male? And we go, we know how that situation was contrived. So, like, we're all constructed in this way. And you've got black guys on my course who were actively and passively encouraged to suppress parts of their culture. Gay guys on the course who are actively and passively encouraged to suppress parts of our culture to be the physiotherapists. And I think for the first 6 months, every patient that came in, I was trying to fulfill a role that I thought other people wanted me to be. And then for a long time, I was filling a role of what I think my patients wanted me to be. So I became in some ways like very doctorly and very dour and using lots of jargon. And in a way, I realized like that's insecurity. If you use a lot of jargon around patients, it's usually a sign that actually you don't understand this as well as you can. If you can explain something like that, your audience is 5 years old, you probably have a much better grasp of it than if you need to use all the long words. And it was quite a conscious process to remove all the jargon and remove a lot of the unnecessary medicalization, and to strip things back to, how do I help you? What do you want from me? And what is my skill set, and how do these two combine? Mm. Like, what can we produce, me and the patient together, what can we produce as an outcome?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting question to be asking as well. In the way that you put it there is, what can I help you produce, or something to that effect? And I think that that I is a really, really important part of it. It's not I as a physiotherapist. It's that is an important part, but it's I as a person as well as a physiotherapist, and how can I bring my unique skill set to that and kind of let that stuff flourish as well. Fascinated from your perspective, mate, when you kind of when that switch started to flip a little bit, were there some conscious things that you did that other people might find helpful if they're somewhere in this process as well? Because like I'm aware that a lot of health professionals go through university, they come out the other side, they're in their early 20s, they have minimal life experience. Sometimes, definitely for myself, my sense of identity wasn't particularly well developed. My ego was quite fragile, and I loved sucking up other people's opinions and ideas and regurgitating them.
And this is the thing. I was a meteor student, having been in the world of work for the best part of 15 years before I stepped into physio. And so therefore, kind of like my route into this was that it was a lot easier to break that, like the glass ceiling, as it were, of like going, oh, there's this invisible thing holding me down and stopping me being me. In terms of like actions, I mean, the turning point for me was I was working in Camden, which is in North London, which is well known as being kind of like traditionally kind of a grotty kind of area. It's very close to my heart. I lived in Camden for a number of years before I was ever a physio, on the 13th floor of like this brown council estate building. There's areas of enormous wealth and there's areas of enormous suffering, and there's a very strong immigrant population, there's a very strong queer population there. It's got the highest percentage of trans people anywhere in the UK, for example. So this very kind of rich, diverse area. And I had this guy in my clinic room who was clearly having a lot of trouble opening up. And over a number of sessions, and usually I think I'm fairly good at getting people to open up, but this was kind of several sessions. His pain was all linked up with the trauma of having been enslaved and sexually abused as a gay man. And the point at that stage kind of hit me that I could not help this person as a healthcare provider. The only way I could help this person is as a gay man and as a rape survivor. And for me, kind of like the importance of that situation was not lost on me. And I was very, very fearful that I would breach a professional boundary, that actually I'd overstep my clinical practice, that I would open the door to potentially like, oh, what happens if I end up getting stalked or this or that or the other by bringing my real self to that clinic room? But in that moment, none of that mattered. And it was just like, okay, I have to reach out and connect with this person on a human basis as somebody who I haven't been where he's been. But I can empathize because I've suffered many of the same abuses he suffered. And we agreed, like connected. That was, by the sound of things, an immensely healing thing for him. And we agreed an onward referral, because a community physio isn't the person to be dealing with that. And being able to connect on that basis that I thought might take months. Okay, the entire session's going to run over. It's going to throw out my entire clinic of like rapid turnover patients. It didn't take that long. It didn't open up loads of doors. It didn't kind of mess things up. But what it did do was make me crave a human connection with my patients. So that was the point where everyone had always said, kind of like, start with an open question when you're doing your subjective assessment, like, what brings you to me today, kind of like thing. And I kind of went through a bit of a journey on kind of like, how do I open, what's the first question of my assessment? Well, like, it's different every time, every patient that comes in. Sometimes if a patient comes in and they're clearly really, really struggling to walk and they walk through my front door, and I can say, look, I've had a refer, all my patients are referred. I say, I've read your referral, I've seen your scans. Clearly you're having a lot of trouble. Talk to me. What's going on? The words "what's going on" almost always feature, because sometimes I've had patients sit down and the first thing is, well, you know, I'm going through this divorce with my husband. And we've been together for 40 years and he was cheating. And the default state of of the physiotherapist is like, come on, chop, chop.
What about your back pain? Like,
yeah, exactly. It's just like, I want to know about your bladder, young lady. But the research tells us that if you let a patient speak, they usually only speak for 90 seconds or so. Sometimes I've let patients go on for 10 minutes because they need to. And they've given them an opportunity to tell their story and be heard and not be looking at a computer typing away. I switched my workflow back to essentially paper notes. I have a tablet that I write on and upload it straight to the computer. So everything is done making eye contact with the patient and listening to their story and one has to demonstrate that you have heard, you have listened, and you've understood. And if a patient says their story and they're talking about, it might be as simple as saying, that sounds like that was really a turning point for you, or that sounds like the sound of thing, oh, that must have been so hard. It's kind of like a bit of a trope, but actually being able to demonstrate something specific to go, not just I'm repeating back to the patient what they've said, but I am demonstrating empathy by saying, how would I feel in that situation? And repeating back to the patient something that was not said. So if they tell me about the whole history and their divorce from their husband and their back pain and their social isolation and everything like that, and saying, this sounds like this is a turning point in your life. And going like, or asking a question that has relevance, like, so where do you see the future being? These kind of questions demonstrate that we've heard and we've understood the gravity of their situation. Mm. There's always the thing, the patient keeps telling me the same story over and over again. They keep talking about, oh, the pain's here, but not here. And it's exactly here. And it's a sign your patient doesn't believe you've listened and understood. And you failed to demonstrate that you have absorbed that information and you're making your clinical decisions based off that. Mm. That's our failing as physios.
Yeah. But I've asked them all the questions, Jack, that they taught me in the communication workshop.
Well, this is the thing. The questions, like, they have to be relevant to that patient. Yeah. Like, broadly speaking, like, providing we know somebody's not got a bladder and bowel problems and that they can wait there and they're not in the process of having a stroke, like, everything else can go hang. Like, getting a patient, granted, like, in the NHS, we've got massive pressures on us, but I found that since adopting this model, my patients need less follow-up. They need less physio input. And my caseload is more new patients. Therefore, I'm getting to see more patients who are desperately in need of care because I've taken on this model.
And now for a quick message. Podcasts are great, and I'm sure you're enjoying this one. But the challenging thing about podcasts is that they don't always improve how we're practicing. But what is going to improve how you practice is the Art of Healthcare team over on Patreon. Now, the Art of Healthcare team's goal is to deliver science-backed insights to improve your human skills, so connection, performance, problem-solving, understanding people, identifying bias, etc., in a way that's engaging, it's practical, and it doesn't overload our to-do lists. So we've got a few members in there at the moment. We're really starting to crank out some awesome content. And if you're wondering what you get over in the Patreon group, well, here you go. Every week, you get a micro skill building exercise. So the who, the what, the how of a micro skill related to patient connection, clinician performance, and thought evolution. In about a page, you get full access to the video interviews from the Art of Healthcare podcast, plus transcripts and reflective questions. You get monthly journal articles with reflective questions and occasional Q&As with the journal article authors, as well as quarterly live webinars with special guests. And every now and then, you'll get another surprise that pops up. And all of this is for about the price of a cup of coffee a week. So we would love to see you over in the Patreon group, the Art of Healthcare team. You can check it out and you can sign up at patreon.com/artofhealthcare. That's patreon.com/artofhealthcare.
And I think for people that are worried around time pressure for when you do ask some more questions like you're positing here, and let mm-hmm. people talk, like the thing that I find with that as well is that they will answer the bulk of the biomedical questions that you needed to ask anyway in the 5 minutes that you let them talk.
Absolutely.
Might not tell you about their bladder and bowel. Some people do. Mm-hmm. So you might still have to ask that one, and you might have to ask one or two other ones to kind of get a diagnosis, prognosis, prescription. But mm-hmm. all of the other stuff is there if you listen and you take it in.
Mm-hmm. And the same with the objective assessment. Like if we're objectively assessing somebody with back pain, like I used to stand back and just let them, okay, show me a range of movement kind of thing. And now I always go through, like I take consent really, really seriously. It's something that we in the LGBT community, like we're somewhat obsessive about consent. And I ask, like, is it okay if I put my hand on your back as I get you bending forward? Yeah, okay, fine. Hand on the back, and then gently place the hand on the shoulder. Now, can you lean forward for me? And the gentle pressure on the shoulder to give another way of communicating, to say, this is safe, I've got you. Like, and when they get to the bottom of their range of movement, having that hand on the back so it feels supportive to them. I can't feel anything. I'm not palpating their discs. I'm not, they might think I am, that I'm feeling something magical, but it's there because there's a human connection. And then a gentle touch on their shoulder, on the front of their shoulder, to get them to stand back up again. So you're not having to shout when they've got their head down by their knees. Like being able to communicate in many different ways, in a very human touch-centered ways, is another way. Like you're just like bridging this divide between two humans. And at university, they teach you about therapy, the value of therapeutic touch, and manual therapy often gets talked about in these terms. And actually, some of these patients genuinely, like patient who's going through a divorce and everything like that, and they've not got kids, this person might not have been touched in a year by another human being. And being able to just have a gentle, caring touch can be enough. I've had patients break down in tears just from a touch, and everything kind of falls apart, and then we can start building stuff up. And so often I think physios are really afraid of having patients fall apart in the clinic room, like psychologically, okay, we've got tears everywhere, and it's like, how do I manage this and keep on time? But it's kind of the lancing the boil, sucking the poison. If everything comes out, then you can only build up from there.
And I think like our job is to help people as well. And if someone goes to that space and has that reaction, it's obviously a really important point for them. It's a really important moment. And sometimes the best thing that we can do is just hold that space and let the whatever's inside the boil ooze out of it, to use your metaphor, or to process that emotion. And we don't need to be psychologists in this instance. Mm-hmm. We don't need to solve every part of that problem for them, but we need to be there for that person, hold that space and have that connection, mm-hmm. so that they can start to process that themselves as well. And like your previous example as well, sometimes there is an important onward referral that needs to be made, that if something is well outside our scope of practice. But more often than not, I find that actually if someone goes through that boil lance and we have a little bit of a chat about it afterwards, like how are you feeling now? What's going on for you? Is there some other support that I could look to bring in here? Would you like to talk to someone professional? Would you like to see a social worker to see if we can get you some more support in this area? Often they'll just turn around and say, no, actually having that cry was just what I needed. Let's get going. Yeah. Let's do some rehab.
Mm-hmm. And genuinely, I can't count the times where especially as we creep out of pandemic here in the UK, that, okay, we've got another blip going on at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say that's optimistic.
Thankfully, it's not going. Yeah. So when I say creep out, what I mean is creep out of infection control, being completely on our back in everything that we do in outpatients, just being able to go to a patient again. Do you need a hug? And sometimes patients will grab me in that moment and hug. And I'm not a short guy, so it's usually right. Okay. Head in the pecs. I could give them a hug and have tear marks on my t-shirt. But there was nothing that patient, I'm just thinking of a patient a couple of weeks ago, and it's just there's nothing she wanted more than a hug in that moment. And she was holding it back. She was trying to be professional with the healthcare provider. And I have to fit this role. And throughout the course of my assessment with her, I've kind of broken down that kind of that expectation of her, she didn't need me to be the healthcare provider anymore. But she was still fulfilling her role as the patient, and then being able to go, no, we're two humans here. I have some skills. You have some skills, and they're both useful right now, but you need a hug. And just the wall came crumbling down, she grabbed me, tears on my t-shirt. And it's that's fine. That was an amazing experience to have as a physiotherapist. And I feel if we're avoiding those moments, we're avoiding getting the best out of our patients and the most rewarding experiences that you can have as a physio.
And I think we're avoiding getting the best out of ourselves as well.
Mm.
Because when you have an experience like that, it draws on all of your other skill sets and all of your other experiences as well to have that connection with the person.
Mm, absolutely. Without these moments, I don't think I could do this job, in all honesty. Before, I'd say maybe 18 months ago, went through a fundamental shift in my my approach to physio, and all of this stuff started coming up, and the equity and the diversity stuff I started to assert myself. And in the last year, certainly that's become much, much more prominent, and people on the social media who battered certainly this Pride Month. I mean, it was Pride on Saturday, and we're recording on the Monday. Certainly this Pride Month, people have been bombarded with pictures of me in leather and showing off, this is who I am. And patients see that as well. I'm under no illusions that my social media is just for, it's my full name. Patients, I know that patients Google their physios, because patients come in and immediately they know. And I've had people who are visiting the department from other departments go to me, I know who you are. It's that physio with the blue hair. And being able to, like, dyeing my hair. Like, when I was a teenager, I had a massive great big mohawk. I was a punk. I was homeless in my early teenage years. When I came out, my dad basically said, I'm gay. And he went, not under my roof, you're not. And so therefore I had a choice. And I chose, like, to say fuck you to everyone and walked out. You can bleep that or not bleep that, depending on
what you want. We don't bleep stuff in here.
But being able to, like, I kind of went through this moment a year ago where I was like, actually, like, I had this, let's say, a realization to go, like, who am I trying to be? And I view this as a very interesting reflective exercise to do. What is the person I am trying to be? What is the person I want to be? And who is the person that I am being right now? So we're separating opinions from actions. We're separating our sense of self from our opinions. We're separating our sense of self from our past actions, because hell knows I've screwed up in the past out of a lot and continue to screw up on a regular basis. It's called being human. And while we can learn from those screw ups, then we grow as humans. And then in 50 years time, we get to look back and go, I'm happy. But every day, so I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. And every time I was drunk, really wash out blotto drunk, I go to the toilet in whatever bar I was in, and I wash my face. And I had this moment every time I'd look in the mirror and I'd be like, how did it come to this? Like, what are we doing? Like, what is going on? It's like the guy in the mirror and me, like the inner child in me. Like, that's such a cheesy trope for so much of this. But there was just like the what the fuck has happened? And part of my sobriety and my recovery has been going through a journey to go, who is the person that the world needs Jack to be? And who is the person that Jack is playing at being right now? Because there have been times where, yeah, I've been trying to be the healthcare professional, or when patients are walking out of my practice with yes doctor, no doctor, I'm not a doctor. but I never told them I was a doctor, but I was trying to act like a doctor. And that doesn't get the best out of people. That's not particularly helpful. It got people to do what I wanted them to do. But that's not why I came into physio. I didn't come into physio to imprint upon the world like some megalomaniac politician. I came into physio because I wanted to help people. And you have to be able to help them to be themselves. And if that means they don't like exercise and they want to smoke 20 cigarettes a day, like, we need to help them be the best version of that. There needs to be some harm reduction, and there needs to be some, right, what is the minimum amount of exercise that you can do to look after your body? What is the minimum amount of movement that you need? The same as if somebody's not eating and we need to talk to them about calorific intake, you need this much. And yeah, like, if people don't find exercise enjoyable, well, how do we find a way to make that work for them? If people don't know how to cook and they're massively overweight and they're eating McDonald's four times a week, how do we help them in the socioeconomic constraints that we have to look after their body better? We have to help them be them.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm not sure how we got onto that. I'm a talker.
Yeah, there was a great monologue there. Thank you for sharing all of that stuff and being so open about who you are as well, Jack. I think it's really refreshing to hear in the healthcare space. And I think we can all learn a lot from you. And I'm still kind of trying to wrap my head around those questions that you were asking as well. I might have to get you to, like, send them to me written down so I can stare at them for a little bit as well. And I'll post them out on social media in written form too. It is like 20 past 10 at night here as well. So I'm probably not super reflective, but I think they're really, really valuable ones. And I think they're valuable wherever we are in our journey. And like, you've obviously been in some reasonably uncomfortable places where you've been questioning yourself quite a lot. And I think within the healthcare sphere, we're not always in those spots where we pull our head up out of a bathroom in a bar and look in the mirror and say, what the fuck's going on here? But I think there's a lot of times that we are experiencing some kind of discomfort or some kind of our values are butting up against whatever else is going on around us in our environment as well. And I think that those questions that you put out there are often really valuable ones for us to be thinking about in those moments. It's like something is making me feel uncomfortable. Something is not quite right, for want of a better word here.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on? What is behind that? And how is who I'm trying to be at the moment playing back into that?
Absolutely. Like this is like you mentioned values there, because like the values are the start of everything. Like what are my deepest values? Like I believe that the people that need healthcare the most are often the people that are excluded from healthcare spaces. Mm-hmm. And they're excluded from healthcare spaces because they need healthcare the most. So they get called frequent flyers when they show up at A&E, but actually they're in ED because they're not able to cope. They're not able to cope because actually they've been failed by a healthcare system. And there's no simple solution to a lot of those things. And actually a lot of the time, what we're butting up against with those patients is the lack of kind of joined up thinking between social care and housing and kind of like all the parts of the biopsychosocial model to go, actually, how do we provide psychological comfort and physical comfort? And how do we provide what this patient needs as a joined up service? Very difficult to do. But coming back to the kind of, if we start from that first principle, what should my behavior look like? Well, I should be doing at least some NHS work. If I believe that, I should be doing at least some NHS work. So if I'm in private practice exclusively and charging what I charge for private practice, then that bumps up against it. And I believe strongly as a gay guy, the LGBT community needs to stand up for trans people. The average life expectancy of a transgender woman is 36. Yeah, most people don't know that.
I did not know that.
We're currently trying to do some research around healthcare outcomes for the trans community and look at some new models of how do we deliver physical healthcare, so non-gender based healthcare for trans people. If you turn up at A&E and you're trans with a broken arm, like half of trans people, if you ask them, will tell you that the doctor spent so much time thinking about their hormones and what hormones they were taking or what surgery that they had, that actually there's a joke, basically it's called trans broken arm syndrome, and it's kind of like, well, why are you not treating this person as a human being? Like what the hormones don't matter, get on with it and cast the arm, reduce the arm and cast it. So this is one of my core beliefs, and if I'm not doing something to actively reach out and help trans people, if I'm shouting on Twitter, that does nothing. Like we've learned a long time ago that Twitter is just an excuse to shout at, for people to shout at people and for people to be angry at people, and the entire platform's designed that way. It's not a town square, it's a megaphone, and if everyone's shouting into a megaphone, it's got chaos. So actually kind of stepping away from that mentality and coming back to, actually, what does my behavior need to look like? What does Jack as a person need to be in order to make the change in the world that Jack wants to see? And we go, oh, okay, I need to suck it up, despite being like, kind of like 100%, oh, I'm going to be out there, I want to be a leader. Maybe I need to be a researcher. Maybe I need to suck it up and do proper research and put my head down and generate some evidence. And so finding out what behaviors line up with your values. And if you're uncomfortable, like we tell patients all the time, like discomfort is a good thing. Yeah. If we're treating somebody with exercise, they should be uncomfortable. We don't want them screaming in pain. I always say to them, I'm not here to torture you, but discomfort is a sign of growth. Yeah, if a patient's got a broken ankle and they come out the air boot and they get moving and it's sore, we encourage them to keep moving because, okay, you're weight bearing through it now and the bone's going to get stronger. We respond to stress as a species. Our existence can be defined as responding to stress. Life can be defined as responding to stress, yeah? So if you, as a physiotherapist, find something that is deeply uncomfortable about your practice, like that is an opportunity for you to grow. And I see so many people going, well, I'm not comfortable with that, and refusing to engage. And we go, well, why are you not comfortable with that? And if you don't know, if you can't articulate, if you can't examine your own biases, if you can't examine your own thought process around that and articulate that in a values-based way, then actually, like, you're not acting as a healthcare provider there. You're being a precocious child, and I've done it. Yeah, just going like, I don't like this, so I'm going to walk away. It's not the answer. We need to be able to come up with, rather than kind of like the minutiae of and like arguing and bickering over these tiny little details about, I think with the Roe versus Wade, oh, I'm choosing my words carefully here. Bonfire, I think, is probably the closest thing I can come up with that's happened recently. That this has come about because everyone's been arguing about kind of like, oh, okay, well, we would do 31 weeks and they would do 32 weeks, and everyone's arguing. And there's this kind of like numbers-based negotiation about, oh, what point is a soul magically injected into this fetus? And nobody's kind of discussing, like, it seems like the whole argument has been kind of gone down this path, and it needs to kind of take a step back and go like, what are the fundamental principles here? Do we believe in freedom? Then we need to believe in freedom of people to make decisions about their bodies. Like, and being able to step back and look at the principles and to start building up an opinion again based on first principles from one's values, to be able to throw out to Gail to go, actually, I probably don't know shit. You know, because human beings can't know everything about everything. So, you know what? I think I have got a reasonable idea about what's going on here, but I have to assume that I don't. Where are my misconceptions? And actively be looking for those biases. And it's become as natural to me because I was forced to. I went through a 12-step program in order to get sober from drug and alcohol. And if I stop doing that, there's entirely a chance that I'm dead within a couple of months. Because when I stop being comfortable being uncomfortable, well, there's always an easy way out. I always say to patients who say, my only goal is to be pain-free. And I go, great, we'll call an anesthetist and we'll get you a general anesthetic. Is that what you want? No. Okay, fine. Now let's talk about what you actually want then.
Yeah. And I think it's a really confronting process for us when we start to like challenge our biases, and when we start to investigate some of our discomfort. It does get easier the more we do it, and the more
it gets fun, Chris.
Yeah,
it does. So fun being able to go, ha, I'm full of shit. Great, let's pull down this entire mountain. When I've had this really strongly held belief for a long, long time that is based on, it's an upside down pyramid, and it's based on an incorrect assumption.
And I think it's like when we're, especially when you're starting out with that process, like you'll uncover some stuff, you'll ask yourself a question and you'll uncover some shit and you're like, I don't actually like that. I'm going to run away from it at the moment, which is a really, really normal response for people to have. I don't think it's particularly unhelpful to step back, because it's going to be really hard for you to kind of process and come to conclusions whilst you're in that space. So running away for a little bit is fine, as long as you come back and ask yourself that question again. And I think, like, going through this process myself over the last, decade or so, like, it layers upon itself over and over again as well. Each layer you'll peel back that the next layer of the onion, and you'll find out something more about yourself, and you'll find out some more of your biases, and notice that you are full of shit in so many different ways. But then you start to actually become comfortable. You'll move through that place where you're like, oh, I'm full of shit, I'm going to run away from that, to I'm full of shit, that's interesting, let's find out more about that.
And one of the greatest tools that I've ever found is a regular review cycle. So a lot of business people talk about this. They're like, and a lot of kind of self-help talks about this. And it's about thinking about every 3 months or so, I need to have a bit of a check-in. I need to say, right, what was my goal? Are we on track to achieve that goal? I say we as a, in order, like, it can be useful to separate oneself mentally into the questioner and the questionee, to the interviewer and the interviewee, to be able to go, okay, if we are interrogating, if you are asking questions about your strongly held opinions, then you cannot be the one holding those strongly held opinions. It's almost like it's a kind of psychological trick that's existed for some time, to go, if we can split this apart and to examine ourselves as two separate entities, or as I tend to come at it from the Jack is examining who Jack is playing at being right now. And so I talk about we a lot, like, what are we doing right now? Because it's me and the person that runs life day to day, the person that operates this mouth, the ADHD child who's having way too much fun in the world. But this review process of being able to sit down and go, right, what are we trying to achieve? Who am I trying to be? And are my actions at the moment linking up and building a world that I want to live in? Are my actions at the moment building a personality that I want to live in? Because we know as physios that the more you do something and the more you think something, the more it entrenches that. We know that from loads and loads of research around pain. And actually, okay, the longer I think about rehab being the answer to everything, the less flexible my brain becomes at changing its opinion on those things. Being able to step back and regularly be unafraid to go, oh, actually, this needs a little bit of a tweak. But every now and again, something will make me really uncomfortable and I have to walk away. And then I write it down. And then I'll come back to it later. And then being able to go, okay, what turned from a snap on Twitter? I'm able to come back to that and go, actually, I didn't DM somebody and go, I didn't mean to put it quite like this, but this is the underlying value behind this. And people go, oh, actually, I get that. And so we go from a personal attack to a meeting of minds, or what's perceived as a personal attack, just because we're all a bit clumsy in how we express ourselves. And taking action that is like, I want to have a meeting of minds with people because we lack that so much in the world.
Yeah.
And that means that I need to know my mind, and the patient or the person I'm talking to needs to know their mind. And then we have a genuine meeting of minds. If I'm playing at being somebody that's not me, if I'm trying to be the healthcare professional, we're not having a human conversation here. You're talking to an automaton. I'm telling you what the textbook told me to tell you. Whereas when we can bring like the core of who we are into the clinic room, and the phrase I always use is one that was told to me in a completely offhand way. So Dr. Geeta Ramtari, who works at the National Hospital for Neurodisability and Neurology, I think that's the right way around, in Queen Square, she was my tutor when I was at university. I'm very, very grateful to have had exposure to her way of thinking. Fantastic researcher, an excellent physiotherapist, a real role model for so many people in physio. And she said to me, look, if you're not bringing your whole self to the clinic room, you do yourself a disservice and you do your patient a disservice. And that kind of really hit me. And I kind of now use it as my job is to show up as all of me. And part of that me is being a gay man. Part of that me is being an alternative gay man. Part of that me is being a gobby shit. Part of that me is being a physiotherapist and reassessing who is the person that is coming into this clinic room allowed me to then take the caring, kind, gentle person that I had developed in the clinic room and to take that out of the clinic room as well and incorporate that into the rest of my personality. Because for so long, I was like, I wish I could be the man I was in the clinic room day to day. And being able to break down that wall to say, that wall between, or that flimsy curtain between the clinic room and outside the clinic room is the concept of professionalism. And professionalism has been used as a weapon against minoritized people since the term was invented, where Black women get told that Afros aren't professional and they need to straighten their hair. Women regularly get told that they have to wear high heels to work in order to be professional. Me dyeing my hair blue was a big middle finger to the concept of professionalism. Gay men get told that expressing our values as a community, that queer values are often very different from heteronormative values because they developed in a space that was excluded from heteronormative culture, and expressing and being sex positive is so often seen as unprofessional. And actually, it's all bullshit. We can be ourselves. You're not going to overstep your scope of practice, because so a good friend said to me, you can't, and she sits across psychology and physio, and she says, you can't overstep your scope of practice. You can be nosy, but you can't, like, you can be intrusive. You can be asking questions that are irrelevant, but like, you have no understanding of psychology. Like, you can't even begin to step into dangerous territory there. What you can be is a bad person. But the being able to be a human being there with another human being in the clinic room, and to take all of those skills from inside the clinic room out, an experience. And there's a lot of conflict in that. I still get into a lot of conflict with a lot of people, and I just have to say, you know what? You don't know me. And yeah, going, yes, okay, you have never seen a physiotherapist who is a gay leather man, but I'm immensely proud to be a gay leather man and to be a leader of one of the oldest queer organizations in Europe, which is the leather scene has always been there behind as soon as decriminalization happened, the leather scene sprung up. And this is like our history and our heritage as a people. And I'm not afraid to wear that on my arm, or the rest of me for that matter. And if that is unprofessional, like, then I don't want to be a professional. If it's unprofessional to be a human being, then, like, why are we even here?
Right. That was beautiful.
But yeah, that was, thank you for drawing that out of me, because that has been boiling up under here to go, like, I should do a Twitter thread. That Twitter thread will be 427 tweets long, and nobody will read it.
Are you quite active on other social platforms as well, or just Twitter?
Yeah, what I'm comfortable sharing, this is still the, as I said before, like, The there is the safer work and there's the not safer work. But yeah, Twitter is the main way that it's still recording. Fine. Okay, I'll do a little.
I'll chop this out.
Yeah, okay. Twitter is the main way that people can get hold of me. I'm cool. Jack_Holroyd. In fact, you know my Twitter anyway, so you can put it in the show notes if you need.
I'll stick it in there.
And yeah, that's my DMs are open. I love getting abused by DMs. Feel free.
How we first connected, actually. Jack, I mean, we've talked about a whole lot of stuff today, a whole lot of deep stuff. I'm going to be real pithy here, and I'm going to say, for the person who has listened to this and, is going into the clinic room tomorrow, what's maybe the first thing that they should think about off the back of what we've talked about here?
If you're, first of all, look around you and imagine what it's like to be the patient walking into your room. Don't imagine what you would feel like as if this was somebody else's clinic room and you were going in, because you know your experience. Imagine what it's like for somebody who knows nothing about healthcare, who might not speak English well, who might not be like, who might be afraid and scared to come in. And if you can't imagine that because you've never been in that situation, find somebody who has and ask them. When you talk to your patients, well, don't talk to your patients. Listen to your patients and take notes if you need to. Let them speak. But if that is going to be worthwhile, you have to demonstrate that you have listened. And that demonstration is the key, which is that you ask them a meaningful follow-up question or two. There's good research on this from a variety of places. I think Peter O'Sullivan's done some, and JP Canero, I think, have a paper on it, that specifically asking relevant follow-up questions really drive home to the patient that you've understood. And then think about, after your first patient, write down a sentence in a notebook that nobody else will see about who you were for that patient. I was a physio that's treating them for their back pain. I was a doctor who's just given them a prescription. Like if you're an APP and you're prescribing gabapentin or for like whatever, and you're a prescribing clinician, like, have they walked into you? Have they had an interaction with you that's just the same as the GP? Because if so, how come the GP hasn't fixed them? Who are you being for that patient? Just a few words. And over time, I know that if I, when I do that every now and again now, at least 50% of those patients, my answer is, I was Jack. That actually they walk out of there and instead of going, I went to see the physiotherapist and he told me to come out of my air boot for my broken ankle and start trusting my ankle. No, I went and saw Jack. And I would, we know that we can ask patients, what would you tell your family members about what you've learned here today? Is a really valuable way of assessing their understanding of the situation. And I want my patients to be able to go home and yeah, they can say, I saw a physiotherapist, his name was Jack, and we had a great time.
Jack, thank you so much for joining me today, mate. I've had a great time, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you again soon. That's a wrap, team. I really hope you enjoyed that one. If you want to support the show, the best way you can do that is to share this episode out with your friends, your colleagues, your mum, someone who you think might enjoy it, and to make sure that you hit subscribe on your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode. For more resources for all the episodes, for more information about the Art of Healthcare team, head on over to artofhealthcare.nz and you can find all of that stuff there. The amazing theme music for the episode was produced by my brother Jeremy Desmond, but otherwise you can blame me and my wonderful guest for the rest of the stuff. Thank you guys again so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for showing the love. I really appreciate you. Have a great week.